Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney, who's with the Institute of the Constitution, and we're going to be talking about this most amazing form of government that we have here in the United States. A form of government that really was, at one time, was the envy of the entire world. And of course, there's always been those who would establish a dictatorship, or those who would want to rule over others, and gradually, little by little, they've eroded away these concepts of limited government. And we've replaced it in many ways with an all-powerful ruling elite, but certainly in the court system, which was one of the means by which we would be able to regulate government, by having an independent jury that could act and determine not only what the facts of the case, but whether the law was just or not. And yet, of course, they've tried to restrict that so that they could have the judges determine the outcome of the case. And it really didn't matter what the jury believed. The judge, in his instructions, would ensure that the person would be convicted or released, depending upon what the judge thought. And we would then be able to neutralize the influence of the citizens on the all-powerful elite. Well, David's going to talk a little bit more about this, the concepts, and how these concepts of the jury have been altered through the years. David Whitney, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan, for having me on your show. It's always a privilege to be with you, as well as your great listening audience.
Well, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story tonight?
Well, we've been talking about what all of English history, and all the way back to Magna Carta, and even before that probably, but clearly the idea of a jury trial was a trial in which the jury was the judge of the law as well as the facts. They were to determine if the law itself was legitimate, and having determined if it is not legitimate, then of course the person brought into the bar, the person accused, is innocent no matter what the facts are, because the law itself is guilty. If, of course, the law itself is legitimate, then they could go ahead and look at the facts to determine if indeed the facts proved innocence or guilt.
And, of course, basically what you're talking about is jury nullification, which at one time was accepted in this country, but the elite who've taken over our judicial system don't believe that. They want, of course, the judge to be all-powerful, just as they want the bureaucracy to be all-powerful, just as they want the executive branch of government to be all-powerful. And the last thing they want is the people who are, of course, paying the taxes and supporting the government, to have anything at all to say about the outcome of jury trials. So pick up the story there, please.
Well, our founders never referred in detail to what it meant when they used the term jury trial, because in their day, everybody understood a jury trial is one in which the jury judges the law as well as judges the facts. And so when you look at our Constitution, people would argue, and they do argue today, well, look, there's nothing in here about the jury judging the law. There are in various other writings. There is in, for example, the Maryland State Constitution and several other state constitutions, a clear expression that a true jury trial is one in which the jury judges the law and as well as the facts. But we want to trace what happened in America, because at that day, at the founding era, it was so taken for granted that they didn't even need to spell it out. A jury trial, by definition, meant a trial in which the jury was the judges of the law as well as the facts. That's not the case today, and we want to, in this program, trace the history of what took place to change the way in which juries handle trials in our land.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And so the Institute supports Radio Liberty, and we support the Institute. David, go ahead, pick up the story.
Well, the value that our founders set upon the jury trial is expressed in a number of different ways. Let me just cite to you what Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Paper number 83. He said, the friends and adversaries of the plan, that is, of the Constitution, so you take the Federalists, who are the advocates of the Constitution, as well as the anti-Federalists, both groups, if they agree on nothing else, Hamilton said, concur at least in the value they set upon the trial by jury. For if there is any difference between them, it consists of this. The former, that is the Federalists, regard it as a valuable safeguard to liberty. The latter, that is the anti-Federalists, represent it as the very palladium of free government. So in a sense, the anti-Federalists held it even a little higher, that it's the essence of free government. If you think about that, in no way, shape, or form today is the jury held in such high esteem, in such an elevated and lofty position as the very palladium, the very essence of free government. Instead, the juries are reduced to a standard level in most courtrooms, and there may be some exceptions, but in almost all the courtrooms that I've ever heard of in our day, the jury is reduced to almost being a simple rubber stamp for whatever it is the government wants. That is, whatever the prosecutor may have determined already, or perhaps what the judge himself has determined, that he's going to manipulate the evidence to see what they are exposed to, what they are not exposed to. He's going to control what arguments are allowed to be presented to the jury, and also prevent the attorneys from arguing points that he does not want them to argue. All of this is then in the hands of a black-robed lawyer and not in the hands of 12 jurors, honest jurors, who are of your vicinity. And given that this is exactly what our founders feared, that a judge would be in control of the proceeding and a judge would be the determiner of the outcome, how in the world did we come to this place today where we're almost 180 degrees opposite from what our founders established and what their vision of a true jury trial was all about? Well, it took place primarily in the 19th century and then even further in the 20th century. But in the 19th century, there was a slow erosion that began of the clear understanding of what our founders intended with a jury trial. And it's interesting to see where this erosion took place. It didn't take place in the legislature. That is, Congress as well as state legislatures didn't sit down and begin writing laws that restricted the jury and prevented the jury from functioning as it should to judge the law. Nor was it the executive branch, whether the president and his office and his departments that are under him. Nor
hold that thought right there, David. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Pastor David Whitney, and he's certainly tracing the history of this movement in the 18th century, I should say in the 19th century, and then in the early 20th century, to neutralize the power of the jury, to centralize the power in the hands of the black-robed lawyer we call a judge. And, of course, this is an honest man, fine, but what if it's not an honest man? What if he is part of a system that wants to determine the outcome of trials and simply uses the framework of the jury to justify his preconceived notion? The judge should only be certainly acting there as a mediator, not a determinant of what's right and wrong, but, of course, the judge says what information can be presented to the jury will restrict many times information that's really very important as far as the trial is concerned. And so, but how did we get from where we were to where we are today, to where no longer is the jury allowed to interpret the law, to even try to understand the law, to nullify the law, jury nullification? How do we get to the point where the jury simply becomes a rubber stamp for a black-robed lawyer? Go right ahead, David.
And as I was mentioning earlier, it wasn't the legislative branch that made the change. It wasn't the specific pieces of legislation they put forward, nor was it the executive branch, either on the national level with the president and his departments, nor on the state level with the governor and his powers. Those two branches of government did not change the jury system in America. It was the judiciary. We're going to cite a number of court cases that are examples of the erosion that began to take place in the 19th century and accelerated towards the end of that century and into the 20th. But it's interesting if you look at not only our federal constitution, but you look at every state constitution, all 50 constitutions, they have a means for amending their constitution. That is, the structure of government that was laid down at the beginning can be changed, but the method of changing the structure of government, the method of changing the constitution, is always by an amendment process, usually a difficult, especially on the federal level, a very challenging process to get three-quarters of the states to go along with the proposed amendment, and so it is a very high bar that must be passed to amend the federal constitution, and the same with the state constitution. A vast number of citizens have to vote in the state to change the constitution. In other words, the constitution can never be changed by the government or any government functionaries or government agents. In fact, the legislature really can't change it, nor the executive branch, let alone the judicial branch. None of those branches by themselves can change it. They have to appeal to the people, and the people have to weigh in and vote either on a state level for a federal amendment or within a state itself for an amendment to a state constitution. The people are the only ones, because we live in a system that rightly recognizes that government is by consent of the governed. If we don't agree to a change in our form of government, that change is illegal. And so if one branch or even three branches of government were to collude together to change the form of government or change even one aspect of it, they do not have the power to do so. It is illegal for them to do so. It's what our founders called usurpation, that they've stepped outside the boundaries and the system that has been set up for right governance. And so for the judicial branch, as we'll illustrate here, for the judicial branch to be the one branch that changed the function of the jury from what it was in our founding era to something entirely different by the time you come to the 20th century is illegal. These people were breaking the law and getting away with breaking the law primarily because those charged with being the watchdogs over the judicial branch, which is the legislative branch, both on the federal level and the state level, if there's going to be an impeachment of judges who are violating the law by violating their oath of office, it's the legislature that has to impeach them and then remove them from office. And in each one of these cases, no, that did not happen. These judges got away with violating the law, got away with changing the form of government, particularly what a jury is and how it functions in the judicial branch, and they got away with it, and they furthermore propagandized the entire country to a point today where most Americans believe that, oh, jury nullification, oh, that's a bad thing. I saw somebody sent me a clip from one of the Law and Order shows, I think it was, but anyway, the whole point of the show was to say that that juror who dared breathe the idea, even the idea of jury nullification was completely out of order and needed to be thrown off the jury because jury nullification is illegal, which is a flat-out lie. But the lie has been successfully told so that most Americans, in spite of the fact that they were to study the history of our country, if they were to study the history of English common law from Magna Carta on down, they would know that the role of the jury is critically important, that they must judge the law as well as judge the facts.
And I think it's important, David, for our listeners to understand that programs like Law and Order, which I enjoy thoroughly, but programs like Law and Order are largely there to create a reality, to distort, of course, the truth, and to get us to believe what the establishment wants us to believe. And certainly the major networks, television networks, are controlled by the people who control everything else, and they will certainly put a program, put an idea into a program to alter our concept, and ultimately our ideas are molded, our thoughts are monitored, our tastes are formed by people we don't even understand. How they use television, how they use motion pictures, how they use radio and articles and magazines and newspapers to alter our concept of the world. Jury nullification is the law of the land, and of course the fact most people don't know that, and the fact that the Law and Order program would say it was not simply reflects the fact that they are creating our reality. It's about time we were able to think independently. Jury nullification was one of the basic tenets of American law until, of course, the people in control decided to change that. Go right ahead.
Well, one of the first cases that was a shot across the bow of the independent jury was the United States v. Batista in the year 1835, and it was actually held a case held in Massachusetts. It was a case on the high seas, so it went to federal court, a case that involved questions of piracy, questions of mutiny, and so on a slave ship, and whether the slaves had a right to mutiny because they were in unjustly and against the law of God enslaved. And so there was a strong abolition movement already there in Massachusetts where people would question a law that says the slave does not have a right to rise up and throw off their shackles on a slave ship and take over the slave ship and do away with the captain and the other crew and sail the ship themselves. You know, so many people on a jury in Massachusetts at that point in time, 1835, would say, wait a minute, that law is very, very questionable, highly questionable, because slavery itself is highly questionable, and we're not so certain that the slaves, therefore, would be guilty. The man who ultimately became Chief Justice of the United States, Joseph Story, and there's many, many good things Joseph Story has done, so I wouldn't want to denigrate his character altogether, but in this case, United States v. Batista, he was wrong, because he argued this. He said that it was up to the, quote, educated judge to give the law to the uninformed jury, and up to the jury to decide the facts. So he's drawing a line down the middle of the courtroom and saying the professional here, who's wearing the black robe, the professional who's trained in law, this is the one who can tell the uneducated, unwashed, ignorant mass out of which we've drawn these 12 jurors, that judge is the one who's going to tell the jurors what the law is, and they have no right or no ability to judge whether a law is just or unjust. Joseph Story was absolutely wrong in this case. He's absolutely wrong. The entire weight of English common law rests against him. The entire weight of our own history, colonial history in America, all the way up until the time of independence, because in the Declaration of Independence, 5 of the 28 reasons for declaring independence had to do with the king's violation of an Englishman's right to a trial by jury, which meant, of course, a trial by which the jury judges the law. So he was wrong, but he fired an initial shot, and of course, because he rose, instead of being impeached, instead of being thrown out of a position, he rose. He rose all the way up to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and so people look back at the decisions of somebody who rises to that level as, wow, these are weighty, these are important, we ought to consider what they have to say. A few years later, in 1843, also in New England, in this case, it was a state case in New Hampshire in 1843, Pierce v. State was another watershed case in how it treated the jury. And in this case, very clearly, the distinct purpose of jury independence was overlooked entirely. You see, jury independence serves to protect the accused from injustice and oppression on the part of the government. Of course, the whole purpose of a trial, a jury trial to begin with, is to see that justice is done. And normally we think, well, it's one person who's done some wrong to another person. He's stolen their goods. He's murdered their person, or, you know, he's done some crime against another individual, and therefore the weight of government needs to come to punish him. But what happens when the government becomes the criminal? That is, the government steps outside the bounds of law, and the government violates the God-given rights of the individual. The entire purpose of an independent jury is to determine when that's happening, and say, wait a minute, the government here is violating the law, which is exactly what our founders did with the Declaration of Independence. Although it wasn't a courtroom, they were appealing to the opinions of the world, and although it wasn't a judicial trial and so forth, they were saying, we have gone through a process, and we, the people here in these 13 colonies, have determined that the king and his government have violated God's law, the laws of nature and nature's God, and therefore we have a right to resist and separate from such a government and form a government which will do justice according to the laws of nature and nature's God.
All right, fine. Well, our guest, of course, is Pastor David Whitney. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we begin to explore these ideas that have gradually led us away from our heritage, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our freedom. David, go right from there.
Okay. Well, that was in 1843, Pierce v. State, one of the watershed cases. Shortly after that, in 1845, and over in Massachusetts, another state case, Commonwealth v. Porter. Commonwealth v. Porter in 1845. In this case, the Chief Justice of the state of Massachusetts, Lemuel Shaw, held that although the defense attorney had the right to argue the law, the jury had no right to decide the law. That is a strange thing. Well, the attorney can say what he wants about the law, and what he could actually criticize the law, that this chief judge was saying, but the jury has no right to decide the law at all, which, again, flies in the face of all our history, flies in the face of the fact of what our nation was established with, a trial by jury and a right to trial by jury. Just a few years later, in 1849, State v. Croatia, and this is in Vermont, 1849, and here was one of the an example of extremely unpopular law or set of laws that began to be passed by the legislatures and signed, what we say, into law by the governor. And so the legislative branch has signed off and the executive branch has signed off. And the judicial branch also signed off on these liquor taxing and liquor licensing, liquor regulation laws. So the three branches of government said it's fine for the government to regulate and to tax liquor. And if you look at the history of our country, the very first insurrection that took place after the formation of our country is called the Whiskey Rebellion. And many people think, well, you know, it's a terrible thing. These guys just don't want to pay taxes. Well, it's a little different than that because we don't understand today the situation economically back then, that anybody that was a farmer usually had very little cash. That is, actual coins, actual money in their hand or in their bank account was extremely limited. And the way they did business is to barter, you know. And so they would have certain crops that they'd bring in. If they could barter them for what they needed, they needed some wool or whatever it is they needed in town. Well, you know, it's difficult to bring a whole wagon load of corn to town to barter in exchange for some cloth or whatever you need. And so the easy, convenient way to reduce your crop, particularly corn, to something that's portable, exchangeable, easily used as a means of exchange other than coins, was whiskey. Everybody could make whiskey if you had corn. You know, you set up your own distillery and you could produce whiskey, and then you could take the whiskey to town. And it was a common means of using, especially in the rural areas, common means for barter and exchange. It was cash. It was the cash crop in America in that day. And so for the state to get involved and say, we're going to tax this, we're going to regulate this, you're going to have to get a license. That is, a license is permission to do that which is illegal to do otherwise. You're going to have to obtain a license from us to produce liquor, was a tremendous offense to the people. And they knew, wait a minute, the government doesn't have any business. We did not put those people in the legislature. We did not put the governor into office to regulate and control liquor. That is totally egregious. And so many juries were overturning these laws. They were nullifying these laws. In this case, State v. Croatia, 1849, at issue was the state liquor license statute there in Vermont. And the unpopular law was again and again being overturned by juries who were resisting the government taxing and licensing liquor production. And, of course, if you think of a law that's unpopular versus a law that is popular, there's no reason, in a sense, for emphasis on jury independence and nullification when the law is popular. But what happens when the law is unpopular? Then it is most important.
Hold that thought right there. We'll go right ahead, Chris. We're talking with Pastor David Whitney, and he said, what happens when the jury simply comes up and says, we think the law is wrong? Whether it would be the law that required people to pay a tax when they have manufactured whiskey, and of course that was the basis of the Whiskey Rebellion, or down through the ages when the people have felt that the laws were incorrect and they simply nullified them, and you said you can't convict a man on a law which we feel is wrong. And so here was the means of nullifying law, at least as far as this one case. We have the legislative process to change the law, but as it applied to this one case, the jury could intervene to declare the innocence of an individual. So pick up the story there, David.
And so here was a case where it was being argued that, sure, jury independence and nullification is fine when the law is popular, but when it's unpopular, they do not have the right to get involved in determining the law, whether it's legitimate or not. And, of course, that completely undercuts the whole purpose of jury independence in the first place. If it's a popular law, there's no need for jury independence in that sense. It's only when it's an unpopular law that this is the way in which the people can resist oppression and tyranny and injustice on the part of the government. Well, a few years later, in 1860, and this is significant because you can see the rapid change that took place in our country after this point in time in the 19th century, and, of course, the big event that took place just then and there was the War for Southern Independence, where the southern states said, wait a minute, just as our original 13 colonies declared independence from England, we're declaring independence, and basically for the same reasons. We believe the government is unjust, the government's tyrannical and oppressive, and we are separating from it. It was not about slavery, and I can prove that by just looking at Lincoln's first inaugural address, where he says he has no intention of touching the institution of slavery. Well, the big thing that began to change was government grew gargantuan in size following this terrible, terrible war. But this case that was right on the cusp of that in Vermont, State v. McDowell, 1860, here the trial judge used his own discretion to decide how much of a role jury independence was to play in that case. In other words, he could say, I'll allow you to be independent in this area, but not in this area. You know, the judge took control of how much or in what way jury independence was going to be practiced in that particular case. And that's a dangerous, dangerous shift. Because if you think about it, it seems likely that jury independence would be most disparaged and abused by the judge in precisely the case in which it is needed most. So why should we trust a judge who's an employee of the government, whose entire career is dependent on people in the government? Why would we trust him with justice and not trust 12 independent jurors who really have no stake, they have no career to advance, they have no accolades or finances that are going to come to them as a result of playing the game in the government? These are 12 independent jurors that are brought in for this particular trial. When it's over, they're done and they're out. Actually, when you look at a courtroom, the only people in the courtroom who have no self-interest in the outcome of that case are the 12 jurors in the jury box. The trial attorney, the defense attorney, everybody in the court, including the judge himself, has a vested interest in terms of their own career and their own paycheck with what happens in that courtroom. The 12 jurors, it does not matter to them whether the trial goes one way or the other. It will not make a difference in their own career. Well, then, after the War for Southern Independence, in 1869, we have another case, and this is in New Hampshire, State v. Hodge. And it's interesting here because they admit something in rejecting it. They go back to the watershed case of Pierce, which was in 1843, Pierce v. State back in New Hampshire, and they cite the case Pierce and assert that Pierce is now the standard. But it's interesting that they admit that before Pierce, before that case in 1843, jurors had been the rightful judges of the law as well as judges of the facts in criminal cases. So while they deny it, they admit that Pierce was the watershed. After that, everything changed, and now juries no longer judge the law. That's the job for the professionals, for the judges. And so it's an interesting admission. These people are admitting their own guilt, that they have transformed and changed the judicial system from a true trial by jury to the jury now being manipulated, controlled, and essentially just becoming a rubber stamp of what the judge and the government, perhaps the prosecutors want. But it's interesting that they had actually admitted. They admit that they have brought about a change, and if you know constitutional law, you know that the change they brought about is illegal because the judiciary cannot amend the Constitution. They cannot change the law. They have no power. They have no right to do so. And when they do so, they should be punished by impeachment.
Well, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We're going to be back here in just a moment to continue to explore this whole idea of jury nullification. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, simply taking us through step by step as the judges and the judicial system began to increase its own power and to relegate the jury to a very inconsequential, unimportant format where the jurors would simply do what they were told to by the judge. So pick the story up there.
Well, following that war for Southern independence, things began to move even more rapidly, particularly as the consolidation of power in Washington, D.C. began, as well as in states. And it became more and more standard to prohibit juries from even allowing the thought of jury nullification to be part of what they were allowed to hear. For example, if we go on to 1891, in this case, Commonwealth v. McManus, this is in the state of Pennsylvania, actually, this case, Commonwealth v. McManus, claimed that, quote, the court was the best evidence of the law within the jury's reach. The jury are not judges of the law in any case, civil or criminal. There they laid it down as an absolute. No jury nullification in any criminal or civil cases. The jury does not judge the law whatsoever. And so, in less than 100 years, from 1835, the Bautista case of Chief Justice Story, to 1891, you have a complete reversal, a complete change of the jury system. And we'll cite some other cases because it's interesting to see that even these, when they are honest, they have to admit that before that, before 1830s, juries were the judge of the law. But after that, we have changed the system. And so even in some of these cases where they talk about it, they admit that a change has entered the picture, and the history shows it's the judiciary that has accomplished that change. So Commonwealth v. McManus, it was a bold, flat-out statement. Juries are no longer in functioning like they were designed to. The next year, 1892, another case in Vermont. This is State v. Burpee. And here, the judge claimed that the jury law judging was, quote, neither sound in principle nor salutary in practice, and was against the weight of authority. Now here they become extremely bold in their lie, because the weight of authority is the exact opposite of what they're saying. That is, if you take the weight of authority prior to 1830, take the weight of authority all the way back to Magna Carta, 1215, and probably even before Magna Carta, but Magna Carta is the first place we have a very clear written standard established of a trial by jury where the jury judges the law.
Well, you're going to have to hold that thought right there, David. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, David is simply pointing out that the whole idea was that the jury was to judge both the facts and the law, and this is the way it had been going back to the time of the Magna Carta. But there were people in this country who wanted to change that. You see, they wanted an authoritarian form of government, and little bit by little bit, over a period really of generations, they gradually eroded these concepts. Those who've studied, and you can go up on Wikipedia, and I suggest that you do Google in jury nullification, go to the Wikipedia article. I think it gives you a very good understanding of what this was all about and how this was gradually eroded. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, there's a long-range plan, first of all, to change the structure of our society, to move it into an authoritarian system under an appointed or a bureaucracy, as we have with the judges in most cases. A few of them are elected, but most are not. And then, of course, to do the same thing with the central government. And little bit by little bit, to centralize all power with a ruling elite. And, of course, we tell us, we're a democracy, we elect our representatives. No, ladies and gentlemen, the people who put up the money elect the representatives, and then they buy and sell the opinions of the duly elected representatives. We no longer have representative government. We have, of course, government that is open to the highest bidder. And believe me, there are people out there with billions of dollars quite willing to reward congressmen who go along with the system. Well, before we go on, David, I'd like you to go ahead and tell our listeners about the Institute of the Constitution, how they can get in touch with you, and the information that is available through the Institute, and why the Institute is one of the most important organizations in America today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. And I agree that it is vitally important, because even this issue we're talking about here right now, jury nullification, that the jury must base their decision whether a law is lawful or unlawful on some standard. I know there is an organization very active across the country that I admire and does a great deal of work, and yet they encourage people to just make up their own standard. Basically, whatever standard they want to choose individually for themselves as a juror is fine. No, that's not what our founders said. Our founders said there is an absolute standard, the laws of nature, nature's God, and our Constitution, federal Constitution and state Constitution. So it's vitally important for every American not only to determine who they're going to vote for based upon knowledge of our Constitution, based upon an understanding of whether this candidate is actually promising to violate the law, as, by the way, the two major party candidates have given umpteen promises to violate the law before they're even elected to office. You need to understand not only at the ballot box, but especially in the jury box. You need to know the standard, the Constitution, to be able to measure the law under consideration by that standard of the Constitution to determine, is it constitutional or unconstitutional? Is it lawful or unlawful? We put together what we call a host kit, which is a simple way that anyone with any group anywhere can communicate these truths. Our constitutional law professor John Eismo, in 12 half-hour lectures that are fully outlined in the student a notebook that's part of the host kit, and two additional lectures by David Barton. All of this gives you an essential working understanding of the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the subsequent amendments, such that you, when you serve on jury, as a juror, you could take the law that is being used in this case and use it if it is lawful, that is, if it is constitutional, and you would have a standard by which to do that. Now, people can order online if they will go to our website. They can order the host kit, and our website at Institute on the Constitution is IOTConline, all one word, IOTConline.com. Right there at the top of the first page is a button you can click to order a host kit online. Or if you prefer to call in and make, place a phone order, you can call us at Institute on the Constitution toll-free at 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. And it's essential, Dr. Stan, for every citizen to have a working knowledge of this. It's absolutely essential, and the only way we're going to recover our original form of government, a republic under the laws of nature and nature's God, government limited by the Constitution as it was originally intended. The only way we can get back there is first by educating millions of Americans. And so I encourage each of your listeners to get a host kit, train yourself and your family, your friends, take it to your church. And I've told people, if your pastor is a little leery about hosting or having a class on the Constitution in his church, have him call me. I'd be glad to talk to any pastor, answer his questions, his concerns, and tell him why it's not just a good idea, it is essential for him making disciples of Jesus Christ, because a disciple obeys Jesus in every area of life, including what Jesus said about the duty we owe to our civil government as Christians. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. In America means you must know the Constitution. I'd be glad to explain that to any pastor or any Christian that has questions. So our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution where people can contact us is 866-730-9796. And if people were to understand the standard and were to walk into the jury box, and if there's only one out of 12 jurors that understand this in that particular case, so you've got 11 people that don't understand the standard, they don't understand their job is to judge the law. If you have one juror who in the deliberation room takes the time to explain what we're walking through here in this series of radio programs, if they were to take the time and take the information and share it with the rest of the jurors, you could stop injustice, you could stop wicked, unconstitutional laws in their tracks if enough jurors across our country were to do that.
And now, David, do you actually have material there at the Institute on jury nullification?
Yes, and we're in the midst of producing a course, a video course that will contain all that we're talking about here with a notebook that gives a detailed outline of each of the lectures and basically equips a juror not just to understand this for themselves, but our ideal is they're going to walk into that jury room for the deliberation and they're going to share what they have learned with the fellow jurors and persuade the fellow jurors that their first job is to judge the law before they even look at the facts.
And for our listeners out there, if you really want to have more information, go to Google in the word jury nullification on your computer and read the article there. Of course, the first part of this article is excellent because it tells you the background of jury nullification. Yes, the elite, the people who really would establish a dictatorship in America have eroded these concepts, but go to Wikipedia and read their article. It'll give you a good background, and then, of course, as soon as the Institute has their information, get their information, and then start using this as a vehicle of explaining to people how America has not gradually evolved into something else. There's been an organized, coordinated effort to change our system of law to deprive us of a right to a trial by jury of our peers, and, of course, to have a judicial system that is a rubber stamp for the judicial elite who have a different agenda because in many instances they worship a different god. Go right ahead, David.
That's exactly true. Well, the case we quoted in 1892 just before the break, State v. Burpee in Vermont, claimed that law judging by the jury was neither sound in principle nor salutary in practice. In other words, it wasn't a good thing and was against the weight of authority. All three of those are absolute lies. They're part of the propaganda that the judges were beginning to pour out across the country to persuade Americans that, no, juries don't have any business doing this.
I don't know, it's really so interesting. As I mentioned before, when I was recently called for a jury to determine whether I could sit on the jury, and the judge instructed those of us who were there, you know, you are not to go to the law library. You are not to study the law. I will tell you what the law says. I will tell you, what you will do. You are not to make any independent decisions as far as the law. Is there anybody here who cannot abide by that? And I should have, at that time, put up my hand and said, no, I don't believe that. I think that you're incorrect, Your Honor. I believe in the right of the people to a fair trial by a jury of their peers, and I believe that the jury should have the right to judge both the facts and the aspects of the law. I just wanted to see what would happen. It was the first time I'd been called for jury duty in 50 years, but they did call me. Fortunately, I did not get on the jury. If I had, I probably would have had to tell them the truth, and that is that I believe that it is up to the jury to determine whether a person is guilty or innocent, not to the judge to shape that trial to go along with the establishment. So go right ahead.
Yes, well, very shortly after that, there was a Supreme Court case, Sparf v. United States, and this is 1895, and this is Justice Harlan that was writing this opinion, and the trial was thus conducted, and actually the case was a case of murder, questionable murder on the high seas, and whether it was murder or was an accident, all that was, you know, there was a great deal of question about it and so forth, but the statement here is that the trial was thus conducted upon the theory that it was the duty of the court to expound the law, and that of the jury to apply the law as thus declared to the facts ascertained by them. In other words, a clear separation by this time, 1895, had taken place in American courtrooms. And he went on to say, in this separation of the functions of court and jury is found the chief value as well as safety of the jury system. So here we have the exact lie being foisted, in this case by Supreme Court Justice Harlan, in 1895, that basically says the whole beauty of the jury system is that the jury does not have anything to do with judging the law whatsoever. That's the function of the judge. The jury just looks at the facts. And he goes on to say those functions cannot be confounded, that is, mixed together. The jury dare not judge the law. They cannot be confounded or disregarded without endangering the stability of public justice.
And of course, they're really not interested in public justice.
No.
They're interested in carrying out an agenda.
Yes.
And what we need is to get back to this concept of justice under God and justice under the Constitution, not justice according to a ruling elite, to an establishment elite. That is what this is really all about. So you go right ahead, David.
And, well, we'll jump almost 100 years ahead to 1962 now. I mean, there's many other cases that could illustrate this, but the point I wanted to make is that in those brief years from 1830 to to 1890, the transformation of our legal system had taken place by the judiciary illegally changing the function of the jury. And the interesting thing is that the constitutions of states, for example, here in the state of Maryland, did not change. Article 23 of our Declaration of Rights, which is basically the Bill of Rights for Maryland, Article 23 says that the jury is the judge of the law as well as the facts in all criminal cases. And it's still, even today, and here in 2008, it is still the Constitution of the state of Maryland says that, which means the Constitution is always the supreme law of the land. No matter what any judge says, it's still the supreme law of the land. Well, in this case, 1962, Giles v. State, the judge insisted that Article 23, notice what this judge insisted, Article 23 of the Maryland State Constitution, which is the supreme law of the state of Maryland, he said that Article 23 was unconstitutional. Well, wait a minute. That is the Constitution. How can you say the Constitution is unconstitutional? What kind of idiocy is this? And he gave his reasons. He said, well, Article 23 fosters the possibility that a defendant would be subject to a trial different from that given to other defendants in like circumstances and that the jury would not apply the law correctly. In other words, you can't trust the jury. You can just trust us lawyers wearing black robes. That's who you can trust. And the astonishing thing here is he claims that it's unconstitutional. And that's on the state of Maryland level. Another case went to the U.S. Supreme Court on the same issue, Article 23 of Maryland State Constitution. And this case in 1963 is Brady v. Maryland. And the Supreme Court in this case actually recognizes the attenuation, that is, the erosion of the jury's ability to judge the law. That is, they admit there was a time in the past, in the murky distant past, before 1830, when juries did judge the law, but now we don't do that anymore, and that's a good thing that we don't do that anymore. This is kind of what the case says. And so while they recognize the attenuation of the jury's ability to judge the law, they note, this is the U.S. Supreme Court, says that the language of Article 23 of Maryland State Constitution, the language of Article 23 does not precisely mean what it seems to say. What an astonishing thing to say. They're saying the words on the page of the Maryland State Constitution do not mean what they say. They do not mean what the history of Maryland says they said when the Constitution was first written in 1776, and this article was very clearly stated, and the subsequent constitutions of Maryland all said the same thing. It doesn't say what it says. Then what does it say? Well, it says whatever the judge says that it says. And you see what the shift is there? You go from a constitutional form of government to an oligarchy of black-robed lawyers. And the law becomes whatever comes out of the mouth of that black-robed lawyer. You don't have a constitution anymore because the Constitution doesn't say what it obviously says. We are in an extremely dangerous position when we have an oligarchy of black-robed lawyers. And by the way, most people, I have some friends that are lawyers that are good lawyers, but most people across America have very, very, very low respect for lawyers. And for good reason. They realize that they're not about justice, they're just about gouging people and so on. And the result of that is that most people don't respect lawyers. Well, what happens when you throw a black robe on a lawyer and you call him a judge? Oh, well, now we'll all respect them. Well, I don't think we should, particularly when these judges are violating the very law, the very Constitution they took an oath to uphold.
And I think it's really so interesting when you go in a courtroom and, of course, the judge comes in and, of course, everybody's asked to rise, you know, in certainly a respect to the judge. Well, of course, it used to be that when the judge came in the courtroom, he carried a Bible in his hand and the people were rising to respect the Bible and God's Word.
That's right. In fact, he held the Bible open.
Right.
So he was looking at the Bible. It wasn't a closed Bible. It was an open Bible. He was looking to the Bible and he was seeking wisdom from God's Word as to what was going to happen there in that courtroom. We have turned the entire judicial system on its head, and you know, we have these kind of statements of the Supreme Court of Maryland and the Supreme Court of the United States saying the Constitution doesn't mean what it says. Obviously what it says, and what it historically, and they would admit, and many of these judges admit in their opinions, oh yeah, there was a day, you know, back there in the ancient past that juries did judge the law, but that wasn't a good thing, and we're much more sophisticated today, and we dare not let the juries do this. So The American people have been lied to. The American people have been propagandized, and successfully to a large degree, and our intention is to change that and to see that that is turned around. Occasionally, however, there is some honesty.
David, we're just about out of time. I want you once again to get out your webpage and to get out your telephone number so people hopefully will get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution and begin learning about this wonderful Constitution that was passed down to us from previous generations.
People can go to our website at Institute on the Constitution. That website is iotconline.com, iotconline.com. Or they can call us toll-free at our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution, which is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again is 866-730-9796.
And I think it's so vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, that you learn about the Constitution, you learn about the jury system, if you hope to remain free. Well, David, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. Actually, I have to say that there are some judges who are honest and have actually expressed opinions, even late in time, contrary to the major flow. But these tend to be disregarded. They tend not to go anywhere. One such case is Justice White in a case in 1975, Taylor v. Louisiana, and he said the purpose of a jury is to guard against the exercise of arbitrary power, to make available to the common sense judgment of the community as a hedge against the overzealous or mistaken prosecutor, and in preference to the professional or perhaps overconditioned or biased response of a judge. So there Justice White got it. He understood there is a purpose for the jury to be a resistance against government tyranny, and yet even when those honest statements are made and historically correct statements are made, the weight of the whole movement judicially is against that. And as you mentioned, that most judges are very clear to a jury, don't you dare get involved in judging the law. In fact, if you even have that idea of judging the law, we're going to throw you off this jury. We don't want you in the courtroom. People like you need to be ejected from here. And yet that is exactly what our founders said a trial by jury truly was. The jury judged the law. The judge was there basically as a umpire, you know, saying, well, that, hey, this is out of bounds and this is foul and so on. But he wasn't the one that made the determination as to what kind of evidence should be submitted to the courtroom. Today, judges, that's standard routine. They block evidence that the jury doesn't ever get to hear. They block witnesses. They block arguments. They're the ones controlling what little information the jury gets, which means the decision the jury makes is based upon inadequate evidence quite often, and it is not justice. It's government railroading people into either guilt or innocence based upon other things. And judges are corruptible just as the rest of us. The Bible warns judges not to take bribes. And that creates a great problem because judges are paid and their career advancement is dependent upon doing what the government wants them to do. And we're in a system whereby it's almost prone that judges are going to tend towards corruption. And our founders recognized that, and therefore they said that they must take what English common law had developed so clearly and so strongly, this independent jury, that would be a prevention against that.
Well, we're out of time. Our guest has been Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Good night, David. God bless. We'll talk to you again next month.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Sydney, I hope you enjoyed our program with Pastor Whitney. It's so vitally important that the people understand what this is about. And if you haven't read the article up there on Wikipedia, why we recommend it to you. Well, I do want to take this opportunity to announce that the Cal Eagle, the California branch of the Eagle Forum, is holding a meeting. It's going to be on September 4th, 5th, and 6th. And they're going to bring in speakers from outside. Sounds like a great meeting put on by our good friend Orlean Kula, who's written a couple of books, and you can get those through her telephone number, going into the Real ID Act, going into various issues having to do with illegal immigration. But if you'd like to think about going to Orlean's program, and it's in Northern California up in Santa Rosa. Her number is 707-539-8393. That's 707-539-8393. And, of course, I think we'll go ahead and put in a plug at this time for our meeting, our October 26th meeting, the annual Radio Liberty Seminar. We're bringing in Dr. Blaylock, Joanna Michelson, Patrick Wood, and, of course, Michael Shaw will be there as well. And we really need to know if you're going to be considering coming. We hope you'll come, bring others. We'll have all sorts of books and videos and other items there, and certainly all of the guests will have their tables. But if you'd like to, of course, to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, get your reservation in. It's going to be a great time. We're going to be serving lunch. We have to know how many are going to be there. Then, of course, we hope that if you want to know more on the subject we've been talking about, why, you really would want to get a book written by our good friend John Stormer, Betrayed by the Bench. Betrayed by the Bench. It's the story, of course, what they've done to undermine our First Amendment protection and twist it around 180 degrees to take God and prayer out of our schools. But why would they want to take God and prayer out of our schools and destroy the moral fabric of our society? Well, that takes us to the subject of the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't read the book or seen the DVD, why, because you can get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America, our future, our freedom are under attack today. And then, of course, we have a number of other books going into the background of what's happened here, America's God and Country. We have certainly the wonderful book by William Federer, America's God and Country. We recommend The Myth of Separation, was a book written by certainly one of the major people who's written about this, David Barton. They've changed the name of that book, and the name escapes me right now, but if you order The Myth of Separation, why, we'll get it by the new title. It tells basically the same story of the fact that the idea of the separation of church and state was simply created by people who would destroy the moral fabric of our society. And you cannot understand what's going on unless you understand there are secret societies that want to destroy America, that want to use America's military and financial power to bring about a world government, which is why we're really fighting over there in Iraq and Afghanistan today, and why we're going to war with Iran, and why we're going to war with the Muslim world, and why we are transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan. Oh, you didn't know we were transferring the mechanism for building atomic bombs to Pakistan? You go to my website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Read my January 2008 newsletter on Sybil Edmonds. And there's so much more material on that today. But we're doing everything in preparation for a nuclear war. And you say, why would rational people do that? And the answer is quite simple. Because we're not dealing with rational people. So let me suggest my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that. Let me suggest my talk on the secret knowledge, my talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. That and so much more information is available from Radio Liberty. Go to our website, look at our various things we have there, and then begin making preparations for the very difficult times that lie ahead, both materially, financially, and spiritually. And please pray for America. Pray for revival, because this is a spiritual battle. But please pray for Radio Liberty. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, they were going to be the views of Eli Mellor for the next hour, but he has an answering machine there on his line, and so we're going to have to... I just say that this open lines, if you have nothing prepared, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So give us a call, and we'd love, of course, to talk to you about any subject you'd like to talk to until Eli comes on, or maybe he's not going to come on. But, of course, Eli has a website, very interesting website, called thetimeisnow.us, www.thetimeisnow.us. And he's written extensively about the war in the Middle East and why we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he actually recognizes that this is a prelude to enlarging the war in the Middle East. Now, I don't know if he would... understand the things that we understand. I don't think he would understand the fact that we are in the process, and we have been for a long time now, of transferring nuclear technology and material to Pakistan so they can build nuclear weapons. But the elite cannot let the American people know that. Now, why do we know that? Well, there have been a couple of cases come up recently on this, but certainly the basic information comes from a woman named Sybil Edmonds, who worked for the FBI, went to work for the FBI shortly after the September 11th attack in 2001. And she was, of course, a translator. She spoke both Turkish and, I believe, Farsi. And she was able then to listen to other recorded telephone calls, which had not been interpreted. And in the process of working for the FBI, she discovered that there was a spy ring. Part of it was right there in her own office. There was a woman who worked there. Who, of course, was having an affair with a Turkish businessman, and she was interpreting his material, and she was just lying to the FBI and concealing the fact that this man was part of a spy ring that was working at the highest level of the American State Department and was actually in the process of transferring nuclear technology to the Pakistanis. Well, of course, Sybil Edmonds was quite upset about this. There were a lot of other things she learned, but she wanted to come forward and tell the truth about this. She reported it to her superiors. She even reported that she was actually trying to recruit her into this this spy ring that was operating at the highest levels of our State Department, and she refused to join. But the interesting thing was that the FBI refused to do anything about it. Oh, they did eventually let the woman go, but they have been actually investigating the same spy ring, and they were ordered by the Justice Department to stop investigating the spy ring that was transferring nuclear technology and information to Mr. Khan in Pakistan, who has built probably several hundred nuclear bombs. And my fear, of course, those nuclear bombs are going to be used in the coming nuclear war in the Middle East. And people say that doesn't make sense. Why would the State Department know that there was a spy ring operating and somebody would put orders in? The FBI wasn't to be allowed to do anything. And the truth of the matter is there really are people who want a nuclear war. And you say that's not logical? And of course it's not logical. We're not dealing with logical people. And there's some information recently, I believe it was in... we can get it for anybody who wants to. I think it was in Harper's, but I could be wrong, where actually this man had interviewed the people in the FBI, and he said, "We know what Sybil Edmonds is saying is true, but we're not allowed to say anything at all about it." Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd be glad to get your input on these subjects. We hope that you're out there listening and that you give us a call, because we have nothing prepared, and it's unfortunate, but apparently our guest is not going to be available this evening. And we're simply talking about the transfer of technology to the Pakistani government, to Mr. Khan over there in Pakistan, with the full knowledge and consent of the American State Department, which had put pressure on the Federal Bureau of Investigation to stop investigating the spy ring. And here's one woman, Sybil Edmonds, who's trying to get this story out, and she goes to the FBI and she asks for permission to put the information out, and she's told she can't. So she goes to the Justice Department, and they impose the state secrets law and say this is going to endanger the safety of the United States if this information is released. She goes to the federal court, the local court, the federal court there in Washington, D.C. They agree with the FBI and that this would endanger the safety of our nation to let the American people know the truth about the transfer of nuclear technology to the Pakistanis. She goes to the Federal Appeals Court, and by this time she has the help of the ACLU. She goes to the United States Supreme Court, and even the United States Supreme Court refuses to allow her to bring the information out, agreeing with the government that, of course, if the American people were to know that we were transferring information to the Pakistani, to Mr. Khan, and transferring, giving the wherewithal to build the nuclear bombs, why, this would endanger the safety of America. Well, I think it would endanger the safety of America not to know what's really going on. But the great tragedy is so very, very few people do understand what's going on. And I don't know what anybody else in the country who's talking about what Sybil Edmonds told the London Times. And actually, there's an article in January, several articles in January of this year dealing with what Sybil Edmonds told the London Times about this spy ring operating at the highest levels of our government. Well, right now, of course, we've got Will calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing quite well, Dr. Stan. And
how are you listening to us? You're listening to us on shortwave or the Internet?
No, and tonight I'm listening on the Internet. Okay. Ordinarily, I do listen on shortwave, though.
Okay, very good.
Well, I've got a book in front of me, Dr. Stan. It's called Salmond on Jurisprudence. It's one you may have heard of.
I really haven't, but hold that. We'll be back here in just a moment and let you talk about that.
Very good.
Right here on Open Lines at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest did not show up, so it's going to be you out there in the listening audience. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we were talking about Sybil Edmonds, her effort to inform the American people that our government, the people at the highest levels of our State Department, were facilitating the transfer of nuclear technology and information to the Pakistani government so that they could spread it throughout the Islamic world. And, of course, she didn't anticipate what this was about. She just knew it was happening. It is my feeling, and I'm firmly convinced I'm right, that this is being done so that the Muslim states will be armed with nuclear weapons in preparation for the coming war. Well, right now, of course, we've got Will calling from Missouri. If you're out there and you have a question or comment on this or a separate subject, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But let's now go to Will. Go ahead, Will.
Okay, Dr. Stan, thanks for taking my call. You know, I don't really want to take you off the Sybil Edmonds information because it's so vitally important for the people to hear it, but in the previous hour with Pastor David Whitney talking about juries and jury nullification,
right,
brings to my mind a book that I have in my library that I've been reading. It's called Salmond on Jurisprudence. It was originally published in 1901. The issue that I have is 1966, and it's a textbook, basically a history of law or a history of the jurisprudence process. But in this particular text, there is a very short paragraph that, when I read it, it really just set my my ears straight up, if we could use a doggy term. But it's called Immunities and Disabilities, and I'll just share it with you. It has to do with the trial by jury. It says, the term right is used in the fourth sense here to mean immunity from the legal power of some other person. Just as a power is a legal ability to change legal relations, so an immunity is an exemption from having a given legal relation changed by another. Now, here's the key. The right of a peer to be tried by his peers, for example, was neither a right in the strict sense, nor a liberty, nor a power. It was an exemption from trial by jury, an immunity from the power of the ordinary criminal courts. So in this idea of immunities and disabilities here, now, Mr. Selman, John Selman, and this particular text is a reference work for those very same black-robed lawyers that we were talking about. But this is turns it upside down completely, the concept of being tried by a jury of your peers. It would seem by their explanation here that it's actually an exemption from trial by jury. It's an immunity.
Now, do you ever have a feeling that what they're doing is trying to get us so confused that you and I, as average individuals, can't understand the legal process?
Oh, absolutely. That's part of it. But it also, I think, shows the change. I would like to go back, Dr. Stan, to the original 1901. You may know that I've done a little bit of study on logical positivism and the way that the words have been changed over the years. But in this particular section here, I would like to go back to the original 1901, even if I have to get it off the Internet, and see whether or not these are the words of John Salmon. Because if this is his words, this would give us an opportunity to look back into the 1850s to understand that this right of a peer to be tried by his peers was an exemption from trial by jury, an immunity from the power of the ordinary criminal court.
I think they're just trying to confuse us, and but I appreciate so much your calling, Will. I
hope you can
look into it and let us know, okay?
I certainly will.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, well, let's go to Bud, who's calling from Flint, Michigan, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. We're just going to do open lines because our regularly scheduled guest didn't show up. So, Bud, how are you doing there?
Not bad. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Do you listen to us on the Flint station?
Yes.
Okay, well, it's good to have you with us. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I got a question about Maitreya.
All right.
Now, I have a friend who has been researching this, and he basically is saying that Benjamin Krem is, that this whole thing is a fraud, that he's basically making it up to make money off of it. And he brings up stuff like the Nairobi, Kenya encounter was all fabricated and different things. I was wondering, I remember earlier in a past phone call where you said that there was a cultist in America that had supposedly seen him.
Yes, well, first of all, for our listeners out there, Maitreya is supposedly the Christ. Now, not Jesus Christ. He is the world leader that everybody has been looking for. And, of course, the Muslim is waiting for the return of the Mahdi. The Hindu is waiting for the return of Krishna. And I've forgotten who is waiting for the return of Maitreya. The Buddhist is waiting for Buddha. The Jew is waiting for the Messiah. The Christian is waiting for the return of the Christ. And the Maitreya is supposed to be, a combination of all of these. An ethereal figure who can mysteriously appear and disappear. And, of course, he is a mystical figure who is about to come and declare himself as the ruler of the world. Now, certainly, this appearance in Nairobi, many of the things that Benjamin Krem talks about, and Benjamin Krem is sort of like the John the Baptist was for Jesus Christ, the forerunner of Christ. So Benjamin Krem is supposedly the forerunner of Maitreya, and of course Benjamin Krem publishes a magazine called Share International. He has another publication I take called the Terra Center. And there you go up on the Internet and read about Benjamin Krem. And certainly, I mean, I've read some of the things he talks about, the appearance of Maitreya, and they all sound a little fishy to me. In fact, you can go to his publications, and he will show you a picture of this person wearing a long, flowing white robe with a white headpiece. He's got a beard, but he's standing in the middle of this crowd of black people, and this is a picture. And what's so interesting about it is none of the black people are looking at him. They're all looking straight forward. And here's this white figure suddenly appearing between them. I would expect that every black person in that audience would have been looking at this figure. It looks like a created picture to me. In fact, I can't help but wonder how much truth there is in this, but I will tell you one thing, and that is that Benjamin Krem basically is possessed by demonic spirits, and certainly Constance Cumby tells about going to actually hear him talk in Detroit, Michigan some years ago. And, of course, the whole idea was that he was going to become possessed by this spirit, and the spirit then would be able to speak through him. And because she was there praying as a Christian, why the demonic spirit would not manifest itself. But there are many, many people who actually are mediums, and they are possessed by demonic spirits. Now, the book you were talking about is a book called Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary People. It is written by a man named Wayne Peterson, who was recruited into the occult movement by a man named David Rockefeller. And it's a fascinating book. We actually carry the book. We do not carry it in our regular catalog, but you can call and request it. Because we don't want people to think that we're recommending this, but for research it's just fascinating, because after being recruited into the movement, and of course being placed into a high position in our government, dealing with Fulbright scholarships, sending people off to Oxford to be indoctrinated in this internationalism, why, Wayne Peterson had an opportunity on several occasions to meet Maitreya. And, of course, he'd even met him when he was very, very young. And then I think he met him about either two or three times, I've forgotten. But, of course, Maitreya had told him that he is about to return. He is going to meet Wayne Peterson and his other followers in Henderson, Nevada. And so occultists from throughout the world are moving to Henderson in preparation for the return of Maitreya. And it is an amazing, amazing story. And I really believe, of course, there are these demonic spirits out there that are contacting people, and maybe one of them calls himself Maitreya. But this is not something to be ignored. But I can understand your friend's feeling that the Nairobi appearance was phony, because I've had exactly the same feeling about it. And I think these people, on one hand, are using it to make money. On the other hand, I believe that they are financing a movement in preparation for the return of what the people on the other side would call the Christ, and you and I would call the Antichrist. Anything else, Bud?
No, that's pretty much it. Thank you very much.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I think it's so important people understand that there is a whole world of people out there. There are millions of people in America today who would say that they are Christians, but are they really Christians? Are they into meditation? They're into the labyrinth? Are they into going into trance-like states and communicating with the beings from the other dimension? They're into a remote viewing. All of these things are occult practices, and they're really rather exciting. I mean, they're really are the supernatural experiences. Wouldn't everybody out there in the listening audience want to have a supernatural experience? Well, let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you don't want a supernatural experience. I have a friend of mine I know very, very well. We usually have lunch together every day, who is a medium. And for 15 years or more, he was into the occult. And he describes actually sitting down and then suddenly moving out of his body and into an adjacent area, and having this demonic spirit come, inhabit his body, and talk. And people would come from all around to hear this manifestation of the supernatural. Well, fortunately, of course, he has become a born-again Christian. But, of course, these things are real. They're not imaginary. They are real. There really is a supernatural dimension out there. And this is what the church is not telling us about. And this is what our leaders are not telling us about. It is the supernatural forces that are there influencing what's going on. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. give us a call. If you want to talk about something, great. Or not, you're going to have to hear me talking about what I'm interested in. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Of course, it's open lines, so if you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we were simply talking about Wayne Peterson's book, Extraordinary Beings, Extraordinary People. And, of course, the tragedy is that there is this other world out there. There is the supernatural world, which most people are totally unaware of. Most people do not understand the Son of Sam killings were a manifestation of a satanic cult in New York City. And, of course, this was reported to the local authorities, but they would not go after that cult. Why? Because the last thing that they would want would be to get the people responsible for so many of the murderers. It was much easier to say David Berkowitz committed them all. He did not. He committed probably one or maybe at the most two of the Son of Sam murders. But you see, the Satanists have infiltrated our police organizations, our law enforcement agencies, and they certainly do not want to bring this out. But, of course, there's a wonderful book out called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Torrey. And, of course, Maury Torrey did a lot of research on this, and not only on the Son of Sam killings, but, of course, on the Manson killings as well, and other killings associated of a cult nature that was out there on the Pacific Coast. And both Manson and David Berkowitz belonged to a cult, or were associated with a cult called the Process Church of the Latter-day Judgment. The Process Church of the Latter-day Judgment, and of course, you can look this up on the internet and get all the details. This had to be totally suppressed. They could not let the American people understand that there really are satanic cults working here. Certainly, we just recently got some material from Ted Gunderson, who used to work for the FBI. And, of course, part of this deals with the murder trial of Captain Jeffrey McDonald, who was a Green Beret, who was actually tried and convicted for murdering his wife and two or three children. I've forgotten how many children it was. And, of course, his story was he'd been in the living room, he'd heard the screams, and suddenly he's surrounded by this group of people. One of them is a woman wearing a floppy polka dot hat, as I remember, at least a floppy polka dot hat. And then, of course, why he tries to, run in to protect his wife, and he himself is stabbed many times, left for dead. And when he wakes up, of course, he calls the police, and by then his wife and his children are dead. They bled to death from the stab wounds. But eventually, of course, he was tried and convicted of their murder. And he wasn't guilty at all. And in fact, Ted Gunderson tracked down a woman who is part of a satanic cult, and he actually has a video, and we actually have copies of that. I haven't had a chance to look at them yet, but they're available. And, of course, this woman confesses that she was part of the satanic cult. And although there is a great deal of information that has come out on this subject, and has been taken to court on several occasions, Jeffrey McDonald is still in prison after 25 years. An innocent man is there. Why won't they let him out when they have the video confession? And they even have confessions from other people. Recently, a marshal came forward who had taken the woman with the floppy hat to see the DA, who told the DA, who was prosecuting McDonald, about the satanic cult. And she was told to be quiet or she'd be sent to prison for the rest of her life. Why? Because there are people within the judicial system who want to cover up the existence of the very real satanic cults that exist in America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. It's going to be open lines this evening, so if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'd love to hear what you'd like to talk about. And right now we have Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I wanted to follow up on that call you had a minute ago about Wayne Peterson and the Maitreya. That's a really important topic. You can go on Wikipedia and just type in Maitreya, and you'll get a really large answer involving all the different facets of this Maitreya figure over the centuries. And Amongst those examples in the definition or the description is the Share International and Benjamin Krem and what they're doing. And that's really a small part of it, but I believe that Krem and Wayne Peterson define the state of the issue regarding Maitreya, though, and it's very important to look at them. And so that's one thing to do. It's really easy for people to get an overview by doing that. And then Wayne Peterson actually has a website now. It's waynepeterson.com.
I didn't know that. What does he say up there? Is he still over there in Henderson, Nevada?
He sure is. He gives an address, a P.O. box in Henderson. And seems to be a big center of all sorts of New Age things going on. It's just a town that they built in the desert east of Las Vegas. And
I think it's so important. Many of our listeners may have seen a movie which came out some years ago called The Strange Encounters of the Third Kind. And it really dealt, of course, with the idea that this gigantic spaceship was going to come back and take these people all off of Earth. And so they were all being drawn towards this one site. And, of course, in the end, they get to this site. It's up in the mountains, and the spaceship comes, and they all get on board and are whisked away. Well, basically, there are people in Henderson, Nevada, who are over there waiting for a similar experience, waiting for the return of the Maitreya, who will take them to whatever he's got to take them to. And this is not imaginary. It's very real. The fact that you're not being told about this by Rush Limbaugh or by Sean Hannity or by the conservative or liberal press or by our religious leaders, well, maybe they just don't know about it. Or maybe they do know about it, and they don't want the people to understand that nothing is going on today that is not in one way or another tied into the spiritual dimension. So go right ahead, Mike.
Well, for those who are interested, I'd certainly recommend visiting Wayne Peterson's website. It's just don't believe it. You can believe that the whole thing is real, that his experiences are real. I read the book. I was impressed. It sounded very real to me. Some of the experiences he describes having gone through in the course of his life, I believe it covers maybe 30 years of his life, would you say?
I think it covers most of his life. He describes even as a very young boy being able to see these spirits appear and then, of course, disappear. He describes this one spirit he saw suddenly walking over towards the window where there were some drapes and suddenly melting into the drapes and disappearing. So there really are, these are supernatural experiences. I believe they're demonic manifestations that he was, and I believe he is demonically possessed. I believe he's always been demonically possessed. And, of course, that's why he was picked to become one of the leaders of this movement, put in the Fulbright Scholarship Division by our government, chosen by David Rockefeller. And then, of course, today, why, of course, he has retired from his government post and is waiting for the return of the Christ, Maitreya. Please, ladies and gentlemen, this is not Jesus Christ. This is the Antichrist, or a representative of the Antichrist, or a prototype of the Antichrist. So
it's starting to look like we could be inundated with Antichrist.
Right.
There'll be many, although Scripture seems to indicate that one out of all those will rise up as the predominant figure, or the 11th king, or however you want to approach the prophecies. But to look at Wayne Peterson's picture on his website, if you click on the link, the icon there on the front page, where it says a word from the author, and he's a pretty good-looking guy, very happy, very attractive, friendly, amicable, and someone you'd certainly want to sit down and have a cup of coffee with.
Well, I think a lot of good people get that. Taken by this, Mike. Let me just put our telephone number out here one more time. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. It's sort of an open line program. So if you're out there across America listening, give us a call. But go right ahead, Mike.
Okay, but with all that bright description I just gave, I would agree with you fully that he is demonically possessed. And that's one thing people have to get used to, is the idea of gross evil being embodied in a brilliant form. One example I could give of that, for those who are familiar with Anthony Sutton's books and The Skull and Bones, for example, he describes...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess right now is Mike, and of course, if you're out there and like to call us, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Mike, go right ahead. You were talking about Anthony Sutton's books?
Yeah, he describes Bonesman as being exceedingly charming. It's his favorite word to use in describing their persona or what it's like to be around them. And we find many of our politicians today who are directly or remotely connected with that sphere of influence as being described as charming. Even George Bush, who I'm not going to even try and describe to you what I think of him. I don't need to, given the way he's conducted his presidency. But those who've met him describe him as charming. Christian people who I believe are Christians who have been in George Bush's presence at prayer, at a national prayer breakfast, for example, describe him as a very strong, devoted Christian. Now, I haven't been in George Bush's presence, so I haven't had that. I haven't been able to make that observation. But I would never believe it for a minute that the man is a Christian. Now, where he's going to spend eternity, I'm not even trying to make a comment about that. But the man is given to evil. Bill Clinton, I've been in his presence twice, and he is a charming, personable man. But I believe he is so completely given to evil, I could just say there's no hope for him. But that's as far as I want to go with that idea. But we've got to get used to this idea of evil taking on great and wonderful, attractive appearances. But Jesus said, "My sheep know my voice." And you'll know his voice, and you'll know those who don't have his voice, if I can put it that way. You'll know false voices when you hear them, and you'll know that it's not the voice of Jesus Christ himself, your own shepherd and your own Lord.
I certainly agree with you, and I think that it's so vitally important, though, that people understand the spiritual dimension, that we are really involved in a spiritual battle that's being played on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield. But it is a spiritual battle because there are spiritual forces out there, and there is a spiritual dimension. And we're told about this repeatedly in the Bible. We're told in the book of Deuteronomy that, you know, there are seers, there certainly are fortune tellers, there are mediums, there are people who can contact the other dimension, and we're told to avoid that under all circumstances. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and we're certainly open lines this evening because our regularly scheduled guest didn't show up, but right now, of course, we're talking with Mike from Santa Cruz, and Mike knows a lot about the occult because he was in this before he became a born-again Christian, and certainly there really are people out there who can contact the spiritual dimension, and what we call the mediums, or fortune tellers, or witches, or Wiccans, or Satanists. We can call them all sorts of names, but they really do have this supernatural ability. Many of them are associated with the New Age movement today, what Marilyn Ferguson calls the Aquarian Conspiracy. I believe all of these people, and the majority of them, think that what they're doing is right, that they are tapping into this other force that can be used for good. I think that most of them do not really understand that they are tapping into a supernatural power that, of course, will claim their souls, and they will spend eternity in hell. I mean, it's very difficult for people, a lot of rational people in this day and age, to believe that there is a place called hell, that there is eternal punishment for to what we do here on earth. And yet, this is what it says in the Bible, and I choose to believe that they're right. And our job is to try to warn people about the fact that just because something is supernatural does not mean for 1 minute that it comes from God. Go right ahead.
Yeah, another thing you can do is go on YouTube and type in Maitreya. It's pretty strange, the kind of things we're going to get.
What do you actually get on YouTube with Maitreya?
Here's one, Maitreya from the West. I haven't even looked at this one yet. I would just say for people, I don't want to take up a lot of radio time trying to get into. Well, now this one I just opened up. It lists the website rael.org. Now that's the first connection I've seen. I think this is the Raelians who were in the news about 7 years ago as being associated with beings that came here in a spaceship from another planet.
Were they the fellow people who committed suicide?
No, you're thinking of Heaven's Gate.
Oh, right.
Yeah. No, that was more like 10 years or so ago. These people came and went inside of about a year. They started a business called Clone Aid, where they were offering to clone people. And they even got themselves an article in a gay magazine in the United Kingdom. The magazine was Attitude Magazine, and I believe that was 99, I think it was, February 99, where they were advertising that homosexuals could clone their own boyfriend for about $100,000 or so. And you could, to your specifications, any personal features you wanted, you could have your own boyfriend by their services. So this Maitreya clip I've got open in front of me, it's not running right now, is put up by Rael, R-A-E-L.org. Those people wanted their own embassy in Jerusalem, but they dropped out of the news about 7 years ago. Maybe we could do a program on that. I could dig out my clippings see if there's any updates as well. But I'll have to look into this one. Maybe we could talk again next Wednesday night.
All right, fine. We'd look forward to it, Mike. I appreciate that. And I think it's so important that people understand this is not imaginary. It doesn't sound very logical. We're not dealing with anything logical. We're dealing with something that is truly supernatural, and there's supernatural forces out there. There are people who've tapped into this. There are people who've given themselves over to the dark side.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to
say,
Mike?
On another topic, I don't know if you've covered anything on the 911, the Building 7 NIST report that came out last week.
I think, of course, it took them all this time to come out and say, gee, that this building was the first building that a steel-reinforced building that had ever come down, but it was just because there were some fires in there. Lots of other buildings have had fires. They never came down, but I think the whole basic theme was, well, certainly this has to be related to the fires. What else could have caused it?
Well,
some people ought to say, well, it was a controlled demolition. That's what Larry Silverstein said. And all you need to do is look at the pictures, and they're available on the website of RadioLiberty.com, where you can see the center of the building collapsing first, and then the base of the building goes. That's not the way steel-reinforced buildings collapse, unless there are explosives there. And there were explosives. People heard the explosives. And, of course, this has all been suppressed. So anything else, Mike?
Well, I just want to make sure people have the update on this. It was just August 21st. You can go on their own website. I think it's pretty important to do this. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST for short. If you just get a look at their press briefing, there's about 900 or 1,000 pages of documents, but just get their press briefing from August 21st, 2008, and they just give you the bottom line of what they came up with. They say that the collapse of WTC-7 is no longer a mystery. WTC-7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from diesel fuel fires. And they go on to explain somewhat elaborately about one of the internal columns that was weakened by these fires from office furnishings, and which sequentially caused an adjacent girder to collapse and then an exterior column. And from there, they end up with somehow miraculously this rapid 6.5-second perfectly uniform collapse of the whole building just from office furnishings burning. This is too much. I can't believe that they would lie this badly.
They have to lie, because the alternative would be to tell the American people the truth and think of the implications. All those people left in the Twin Towers to die simply so they could justify getting us into a war.
If they had taken all of the furnishings in the whole building and piled them up around that one column, number 79, that they talk so much about, and burn all their chairs all in one pile, I don't think it would work.
I don't think so either. Hey, we're going to have to run, Mike.
Okay.
We got some other people waiting here, and let's go to Wade, who's calling from Virginia. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Wade. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing just fine. Speak right up there.
I'm just driving along here, and I'm listening to the conversations, and I was hearing some things about, you know.
Now, how are you hearing us? Hearing us on the internet, on the shortwave, or what?
No, I'm talking on my cell phone.
But how are you hearing the program?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm listening to the radio.
Okay, fine. Oh, do you mean there's a radio station there in Virginia that's carrying it tonight?
Yeah, there is. Hold on a second.
All right, fine. Well, we didn't know we had an outlet. What's that?
It's looks like it's FM 1019 or 109.1.
All right, fine. Well, I'm glad you're hearing this. So do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. We were talking about, you guys were talking about evil spirits and stuff. I wanted someone to maybe expound on the reality of hell.
Well, of course, we have a four-tape set on Whatever Happened to Hell. We've got some books suddenly written by a man who actually was a doctor who took care of a lot of patients who had gone to hell and come back again. But I think our four-tape set on Whatever Happened to Hell is probably one of the best things there. The thing is that at one time, of course, they used to talk about hellfire and damnation. The whole idea that there is punishment for doing the wrong thing and violating God's laws, but they've taken any mention of hell out of our seminaries. A lot of our ministers don't even believe in hell anymore. Go right ahead.
Exactly, and I was, I've been listening to seeing programs on television, and I've been hearing testimonies of people that have died and briefly went to hell, and the stories that they describe, the heat and the suffering and the isolation and the darkness and the evil spirits, no presence of God, amazing that kind of language, that kind of dialogue doesn't get a lot of airtime.
You're exactly right, but you see, there is an obvious attempt to cover up the existence of hell, and of course we have that. What happened? We have this Whatever Happened to Hell, and actually, of course, it's interviews with Dr. Kathy Burns and a Dr. Maurice Rawlings. Dr. Rawlings was actually a cardiologist, and he had, of course, dealing with people with bad hearts. A number of his patients died and went to hell. And, of course, basically he says, you know, you often hear these stories about somebody dies and they go to heaven and they see this beautiful light and this wonderful place at the end. He said this is not the story that his patients would tell him. They would tell him about going to this terrible place and frightened to death. And, of course, he would resuscitate them because he was a cardiologist and suddenly with medication and CPR, while he was able to resuscitate them. And after he heard these stories from a number of his patients, he began to realize that maybe this place of hell was real. This is really one of the most wonderful stories, one of the best four tape sets we have, and hardly anybody ever buys it anymore. But Whatever Happened to Hell, 2 hours with Kathy Burns, Dr. Kathy Burns, and 2 hours with Dr. Maurice Rawlings, and I think it's really an outstanding source of information. But, you know, certainly one of the greatest sermons ever given in the United States was given by Jonathan Edwards back in the 1730s. And was that, along with the preaching of John Wesley, was responsible for bringing about this first great awakening here in America and turning our people back to God. But, of course, because this is such an effective means of reaching people, this information is being actively suppressed today, and mention of hell has been fairly well removed from our seminaries. In fact, most of our seminary graduates today don't even believe in hell. You have anything else you want to say, Wade? Wade, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, do you have anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I was going to say that that visiting, visiting heaven would change the life as well. And I've heard testimonies of people that have gone to heaven and came back, changed people, and you know, that would be amazing to have a changed life after seeing something like that, and never be the same again. Never have to have a restlessness or a bored or no productivity because this life with God is real and it's exciting.
Oh, really?
And,
is.
I'm just glad to listen in and be a part of the conversation, and I'm gonna get off the phone now. I've got sort of a frog in my throat, but. It was nice talking with y'all, and I hope someone else calls in with some good information about their experience.
All right, fine. Thanks very much for calling. Wade from Virginia. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
all right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we actually have a book. We carry the book, and we actually carry the four-tape set of my interview with a gentleman who has spent 90 minutes in heaven. And I've forgotten what the four-tape set is, but maybe we sent the interview out with the book. I'm not certain. I think maybe that's how we do it. But the book is 90 Minutes in Heaven. It's the story of a minister who was involved in a terrible, terrible automobile accident and, of course, died. And, of course, he was pronounced dead by the paramedics who were there. And they were waiting first for the emergency people to come to cut him out of the car. He was trapped in the car. His body was mangled. And another minister, this man was a minister returning from a meeting, and another minister got into the car to just pray over the dead body and started singing. And, of course, this corpse began to sing as well. And it turned out he really wasn't dead, or perhaps he had been dead and come back to life. Well, his story, of course, is that he really did go to heaven. He saw what it was like in heaven. It was a wonderful place. But remember, this is a man who was a minister of our Lord. And, of course, the importance of the book is not so much his testimony as to going to heaven, because we've heard similar testimony from many people who actually, I believe, have been to heaven, and for one reason or another, God has sent them back to earth to have an impact. But, of course, the importance of this story of 90 Minutes in Heaven was what this minister was able to do to impact on other people's lives after he'd gone through the terrible suffering of years of surgery and reconstruction. And because I can sympathize with him, because his body was shattered, and I took care of many bodies like that, you know, when I was practicing orthopedic surgery and having to piece them back together, and the pain that people go through. And today, of course, he can walk, but he doesn't walk very well. But at least his mind is intact. But the beauty of the book, and if you've never read it, we do carry it, 90 Minutes in Heaven, is the impact that one person's life can have on so many other people, especially those who are going through the terrible situation of having their own shattered bodies and having to have them, you know, repaired, and then, of course, to get on with their life afterwards. And many times their lives are not the same. But the wonderful opportunity that the minister had to touch so many other people's lives after having gone to heaven, having been sent back here, and having had to endure this terrible, terrible suffering of reconstruction. And yet, of course, the impact of one man's lives on the lives of many other people. And so if you're interested in getting the book, 90 Minutes in Heaven, and I believe it comes with my interview with him, I think you'll find it fascinating. It really, of course, is one of the most thrilling, uplifting stories that we've heard here, and we hear many, many here at Radio Liberty. So on one hand, you have 90 Minutes in Heaven and the DVD, interview that goes with that. And then, of course, you have the four-tape set, Whatever Happened to Hell. And Dr. Kathy Burns has a little book on the same subject, What Happened to Hell. It may not be the exact title, but it's Kathy Burns' book on hell. It's a little pamphlet. We don't talk about hell now. But then, of course, we've really changed so much of the message and the music of our churches today. There's been a conscious effort, organized, orchestrated, a very carefully coordinated effort to change the message of Christianity away from what it was, a very successful message that carried people close to our Lord. People, of course, spent their whole lives, you know, being aware of the fact that there is ultimately a judgment in the end, and you certainly want to be one of those who goes to heaven, not one of those who goes to hell. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course it's open lines. If you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And of course we've covered all sorts of subjects this evening, from Maitreya, the Christ, at least a man who is said to be the Christ, but not Jesus Christ. Understand that when they refer to Christ, they're referring to a station of life, an ethereal being, of course, who is going to be one of the leaders. But, of course, our Lord is Jesus Christ, not the Christ. So be very, very careful when you hear people saying, oh, I believe in Christ, but what Christ do they believe in? And until people really understand that we are dealing with spiritual issues, and there are literally millions of people in America today who believe in the Christ, but not in Jesus Christ. And when you hear these stories about, you know, 94% of the people are Christians, they never bother to stop and question what Christ are they worshiping. And, of course, not the Christ of the Bible at all, but this ethereal figure that seems to make miraculous appearances and then miraculous disappearances. And you can get this, of course, in the writings of Benjamin Cram or Wayne Peterson or so many of the other people. Wayne Peterson's book, which we do carry, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings, is very important because it gets into Gorbachev and the fact that Gorbachev is deeply involved in the occult. In fact, what most people have never understood is that communism and the communist movement is a spiritual movement. It is a satanic spiritual movement that worships, of course, a different god. And, of course, Karl Marx was a Satanist, and certainly all the indications are that Stalin and certainly Gorbachev is a Satanist. If you were to believe the writings in Wayne Peterson's book, and I do believe that he's absolutely correct when he talks about certainly the relationship between Mrs. Gorbachev and Sai Baba, the Indian mystic. And those of you who haven't read the writings of Tal Brook, who was a disciple of Sai Baba, I think it's called The New World Order. Oh, no, When the World Will Be as One. And his subsequent book, I believe, is The New World Order. It's a very important book, a lot of great information in it. But, of course, Sai Baba is a key figure on the other side, on the mystical side. And Gorbachev and his wife are very, very close to this. And this is why so many of our leaders follow Gorbachev, because they themselves are involved in this mystical goal, this mystical purpose to bring about a one-world government, to bring about a one-world religion, and to bring about a new one-world leader. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course I will comment that we do carry the book, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary People by Wayne Peterson, but if you call and ask for it, why, you must, of course, specify it's on the research catalog, not the regular catalog, and of course you call 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get the book, 90 Minutes in Heaven, with my interview with the author, it's really very good. If you'd like to get the book on Whatever Happened to Hell, or the four-tape set, Whatever Happened to Hell, we recommend this material to you. And, of course, the interviews with Maurice Rawlings, Dr. Maurice Rawlings, the cardiologist who started out as an atheist. But, of course, after coming in contact with so many people of his own patients who had died and gone to hell, why, of course, he became an evangelical Christian as well. So if you could certainly go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, that's RadioLiberty.com, and look at the various items we have listed there, the four tape sets, the videos, the DVDs, the books. We try to be a resource for people all throughout the world who want to get the information, don't know where to get it. And, of course, you can come to Radio Liberty, and hopefully we will have access to this, or either the books or the four tape sets or videos or four CD sets that will allow you to educate yourself. Now, of course, you have our permission to copy anything that you've purchased from us, and as long as you copy it and don't make a profit on it, we want you to help us get the information out, because we hope to touch people's lives, to get them to understand the true spiritual nature of what's going on today. And believe me, it is impossible to understand from a logical point of view why, as we mentioned earlier in this program, our leaders would be transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan and to Dr. Khan over there in preparation for a nuclear war. It doesn't make sense unless you read Ezekiel 38 and 39, and you know that there is coming a war where the people on the islands to the west, and I believe that's America, oh, their flesh will melt from their faces. Well, of course, this is written by Ezekiel, 600, 500 years before Christ was born, anticipating the future. And there's so many things in Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39, anticipating what I believe are the days that are coming to pass today. And certainly, at no other time have all of the various nations of the world been aligned as they were described at that time. And, it, of course, it's only recently that Israel has been reconstituted as a nation. We have a great prophetic set, and actually there are five CDs in each part of the Final Countdown 1, Final Countdown 2, and put out by Pastor Billy Crone, is going to be a frequent guest on our programs. But you'll want to really get these CD sets. There are five CDs, and I should say DVDs, and in each volume, Volume 1 and Volume 2. But the information he has there, from the scriptures, telling us what the future holds, is remarkable. He has an excellent presentation. But more than that, he has a lot of videos, and you want to see the visual representations of the things that he has put together. And, of course, they all point to one thing, and that is the validity of the scriptures. And I, you know, I've been around a long time. I'm 79 years old. The longer I live, the more convinced I am that God does rule in the affairs of men. And if you don't have a personal relationship with him, if you're not sure where you would spend eternity if you were to die tomorrow, let me suggest that you get down on your knees and ask God to take control of your life, and because we really are involved in a spiritual battle being fought on the political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, and we're all going to live throughout eternity. The only question is, where are we going to live? And if you were to die tomorrow and you were to stand before the pearly gates and you were to ask, why should you be admitted? Do you know what the answer would be? Because I would tell you, most people get the wrong answer, and you don't want to spend the eternity in the other place. Please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty.